Big there, Matt, please. Here he comes, riding on his white horse. A cloud of dust. A cry of hi-yo. It's on the tip of my tongue. A cry of hi-yo. Gee, hello. Boy, we're way down in volume today. A cry of hi-yo. I'll check everything here. Hello, test. Yeah, I guess it's all working. Sorry. Well, hello. There, that's, nah, I don't know. A cry of hi-yo. And a shout of, by the way, you know, speaking of a cry of hi-yo and all the rest of it, hello, I'll get a little closer to the mic here. Maybe that'll get a little, that'll sound a little better? A little better? Sounds okay now and there? It doesn't? Sounds fine. Very good. We're on the air, just like gangbusters. Bum, 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 da-dum, 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 da-dum. Incidentally, that reminds me, in the event of the last couple of weeks, the indescribable, ridiculous events of the last couple of weeks. Oh, man. I mean, where's it all going to end? I mean, you know, science fiction has nothing on our world. I mean, you agree? Eh? There's no fiction can approach it. You know, I'll tell you, though, here it is. You know, it's Saturday, and it's summertime. And everybody's got you're torn between two things, you know. On the one hand, is the you know, the great and tragic events of our time, which certainly are, and on the other hand, you're also torn by your private world. You know, you're torn between the two, and the one side, if he wants to go out and you know, blow horns and yell, and the other side wants to sit in the corner and hold a skull in your hand. You know, look gloomily out into the middle distance and say, alas, poor Uncle Sam, I knew him well. And that's not a bad image. But nevertheless, these two things are constantly battling. And yet you can't, if you got a certain kind of mind, you can't steer clear of the totally sublimely ridiculous, you know, they hit you once in a while. Like the other day, I'm sitting in this elegant French restaurant, see, and I'm with about five very elegant types, very official guys, very official. And the one guy says to the crowd in general, he says, oh boy, you can see concern coming out of his face. Oh, what events, what a time we're living in. Oh, everywhere. He says, what, such a hazari. Well, the guy next to him says, hey, you know, geez, I haven't had any of that lately. He says, you know, there's a little place up in Yorksville. You used to get this great hazari. It comes with citron on top of it. And he went on for about 20 minutes, you know, talking about hazari. And he says, you know, I like it especially when they put the whipped cream on it with the little pieces of, chipped chocolate on the top. And suddenly our entire crowd was talking about strudel. And it all started with a guy saying, I such Hazari. Would you please give me a little Hazari music? Together now, gang. Put up with so much. You like that? Ah, oh, gee. Summertime does it, I'll tell you. Get all carried away. How you like my new shades? You like them? Well, of course, with modern man, shades are almost as important as his shoes. Yeah. Oh, wow. Boy, you don't know what blowing a kazoo takes out of you. I imagine it takes even more out of listening, if you listen to a kazoo. Well, just some people just can't stand that sound. I notice that just everywhere. And, I think you don't mind if I salute the tonight, on Saturday night, everybody's got the itch. And, I'll bet right now 50 million people in this immediate listening area within the 5,000 state area that is covered by this monster voice here. I'm fully convinced that out of that 50 million people that are out moving out there, bumper to bumper, struggling to get to the great outdoors, bumper to bumper, the average guy has a deep thing in his mind. In fact, it's a thing that has to do with the noble savage, that somewhere, someplace, is a true Marlboro man. And if you if you can only get to that place, if you notice the Marlboro Men commercials are getting groovier and groovier. Have you seen the one where the guy flies the twin? Yeah, it says, you got a big spread. Oh, yeah, those are great. I think the Marlboro commercials are probably as close to the eternal dream. I'm talking about the dream fantasy of the average Walter Mitty. Hey, come on, it says, you got a big spread. Sometimes you need more than a horse under you, partner, to cover 5 million acres in the Texas Badlands. You got a big spread. Your cattle are stretched out over 5,000 acres. And at dawn, you got to get out and see how they're doing out in the West 40. And then there's a shot. You see this guy in a big Texas hat taking off in a twin engine. You've seen that one? And he goes sailing out over the countryside at about 250 feet. And he's booming around the area there looking for his cattle. and the average guy, you know, the average klutz works in, he works in a place like the Costa County Department of Equitable Life Insurance Company of Passaic. And, his biggest excitement was the day that he got his finger caught in a number 422 IBM calculator. And they had to call the pull motor, you know. He was so excited because he cut his hand. You know, average guy is very, very conscious of his physical body. Probably, this is a largely unrecorded thing, you know. Not many articles have been written on the advancing fear of pain. People today fear pain almost like the blight. And everybody's afraid of pain. So they got 5,000 new types of anesthetics, which reduce the pain. Can you imagine going to a dentist and you get in the chair, see, and you're ready to go, and you've got, let's say, you've got a giant impacted tusk, and it weighs 7 pounds. It's got 28 roots on it, and it goes all the way. The roots go all the way down to your kneecaps, and it's a tremendous tooth, and it's fallen apart. You know, ever since you were 10, you've been eating Mary Janes and drinking various types of soda, and now your tooth is a volcano in your mouth, and it's ready to explode. So the dentist sits you down in the chair, and he says, all right, I'm glad you came in. He says, if you hadn't done this sooner, your whole head would have rotted. So let's go. And he hands you a bullet. He says, here, bite this while I go to work. And have you seen these in the John Wayne movies where Glenn Ford is always going to operate on somebody and John Wayne is the colonel of cavalry? somebody like Ward Bond. Ward Bond is always in these. And Ward Bond gets shot, you see. He takes a mini ball from the Confederates. And here he is now. He's lying on this bed. And, you know, his sweat is pouring out. And Glenn Ford is the troubled surgeon who recognizes the fact that the war between the states is a terrible tearing asunder of good men. And like all doctors in war movies, he's a drunk. You see, that's something that you must, that's another convention, see. He drinks because he has seen too much of the truth, we assume. You saw that in Mr. Roberts. You remember, by the way, that was there's a great actor who has, hardly anybody has given him the credit. I think he had more aplomb and he had more tongue-in-cheek comic qualities than most of the guys that get credit for comedy. William Powell. I thought Powell, he just exuded it. You know, wasn't he great? Did you ever see him in My Man Godfrey? I mean, I'll tell you, if you really ever get a chance to see two movies and you'll see two guys doing the same role, you'll recognize the genius of William Powell. He did it with Carol Lombard, I believe, and it is a classic in tongue-in-cheek, sardonic, ironic humor. It just came out of his eyes. He didn't have to do anything. He didn't have to wave his arms or anything like that. And the mug, you know, he didn't have to do any Jonathan Winter shtick to make you laugh. Just a little twinkly, little thing in the eyes, say. And there was a look of decayed elegance. There was an opening scene of him in the dumps. Did you see that, where he's sitting around in the junkyard, in the dumps, down on the East River? Believe it or not, it was in the area of what is now Sutton Place. And, which is kind of strange. And here he's sitting here. He was the most elegant bum who ever lived. And he's sitting among all his crud, and he's got he's got whiskers all over him, and he's got this old raincoat on, this old crummy old, you know, it's like a Salvation Army coat, and he's got a slouch hat, and he's sitting there, and he's with his buddies. But no matter what you did to William Powell, he exuded fantastic maturity and at the same time humor and on top of itness. That's all, you know. And so then, if you get a chance, then see the same role played by David Niven. And it's a completely different kettle of fish, if I may use the expression, because it was. Oh, man. Who was the girl in the David Niven? June who? Havoc? I can't tell through the window. It looked like you said Ruth Edding. That can't be. Who was it? Oh, June Allison. Oh. Can you imagine June Allison trying to do a Carol Lombard? Holy smokes. But, you know, really, that's like Mickey Rooney trying to imitate Judy Garland. But nevertheless, he may pull it off better, but this kind of, you know, exuding this stuff was... And this is all part of the Walter Mitty dream, you know. I think movies are generally Walter Mitty'sville. Everybody in movies, you know, they're so dashing and so fantastic and funny, or they're a villain even. I suspect that mafia guys go to see the real guys. I can just see a mafia guy sitting in front of his TV set at home, you know, in Jersey someplace, and on comes Robinson, E.G. Robinson, say, playing Scarface. You know, he's got that white hat. He comes out and the big black limousine comes hurtling around a corner at the mafia. Give me a little of that mood music, Matt. A little mood music, a little good, solid mood music, Steve. You know how the narrators in those movies always said, evil stalked the streets of Metropolitan City. Night after night, the giant presses turned out stories of crime and corruption. And on the west side of town, Scarface Al prepares another raid. What a scene. What a scene. I can see the mafia guy says, hey, get two fingers in here. I want two fingers to see this scene. That slob. Bring two fingers in here. I want them to see how it should really be done. And you see Scarface. You remember the scene where Edward G. Robinson... He takes his 45. He had this 45 looked like a service automatic, and he lays it down on the table. You know how he was a silent. There's another guy, by the way, that exuded when he wanted to. He exuded fantastic involvement. Compare Edward G. Robinson playing Scarface Al. Compare him to Rod Steiger, and the difference is catastrophic. Because you see, today's actor, like almost everybody else in today's world, is involved with himself. He's more interested in doing an acting job in caps. You know, he's more interested in aiming for the big, aiming for the Oscar, or in being him. You see, whereas obviously Edward G. Robinson came out of the days when he was playing Scarface, and you hated him. I mean, he lays this gun down on the table. He just slaps it down. And he's wearing this white hat, you know, this big fedora type hat. By the way, have you seen that? That's another thing. Those hats are coming back, Matt. You see that? Yeah, with the big brim, the white, big white hats. In fact, I saw one over here that my old man would have been glad to wear. But, you know, Scarface lays this 45 down on the table, and he just looks around. He looks from one member of his gang to the other. Remember, this is his gang, say. He looks from one to the other. There's a long scene. And finally, he says, any questions? And there ain't. There ain't no questions. You know who the boss is. Well, I think modern man, I mean, all of us, every last one of us, living abstract lives, are searching for people who really do things. action. They really do things. And so guys line up before Cinema 7, or, Cinema Verite, or, Auteur Cinema. They line up in front of long lines, people who don't do anything in their own lives except buy a ticket. As a matter of fact, many a guy prides himself on the fact he can get a ticket to any show in town. I'm a man of action. You want to go see Dolly? I get you a ticket. In other words, action consists of getting a ticket to see other people pretend to do action that they themselves could never conceivably do either, including the author. It gets to be very complex, see? So ultimately, a real guy that does real things is almost a mythological character. He doesn't go to the movies. He does these things. I don't think a real cowboy, can you imagine a real cowboy standing in line to see the Midnight Cowboy? You know, yeah, I can, actually, because you see, even the guys that do real things suspect that they're not the real ones. Because guys in movies that do real things seem to do real things with much more flair than the guys in real life do real things, the very same things. Oh, yeah. Oh, it gets all involved. It's like a Chinese puzzle, you know? And so we sit night after night watching little screens, waiting for some guys to come out and do real things, until eventually, please, hit it big. Set it back. That's got to come on big. Technical problems in the control room has caused me once again to come on in the middle of my mood music. I mean, can you imagine Humphrey Bogart in a big scene with Lauren Bacall, and all of a sudden they bring on Yes Sir, That's My Baby, played by a harmonica band, and he stops. Wait a minute, hold it, folks. Hold it. Start at the top, Dimitri, and he does. Oh, fantastic. And high atop the Empire State Building over a threatened city, a giant creature of the jungle clings, fighting for his life. That reminds me, this is WOR New York. I'm sorry, I had to do it. Lum ba dum bum, bum ba dum bum. And a battle city, preparing to fight for its very existence, mobilizes its forces as a giant creature out of the primal past threatens the existence of every man, woman, and child of Megalopolis. And yet, that giant creature, in his animal, primal, instinctual, deep inside, realizes that he is doomed. He is doomed against the modern man. You know what that is, in case you're curious? That is the mood music, the King Kong. And reset that, and imagine the scene, see? You gotta imagine the scene of if you ever, of course, everybody and his brother has seen King Kong. It's one of the great music. Oh, listen, that movie, I can't help but look at it every time it shows up. It's a great classic, and there's so many elements in it that make it a classic. And all, of course, among the elements, of course, are man's decadence. That runs through this movie. If you remember all the decadent people who have arrived in the lobby of this theater, wherever it was, where King Kong was to be displayed, this great giant creature from out of the jungle. Of course, this movie was made before the atom bomb. And today, if they were to make it today, the atom bomb, there would be an opening scene of the atom bomb going off, which is one of the great cliches of our modern day fantasy movies. Always there's, when you see the atom bomb, it opens up like this. And it's a tremendous scene. You see this great mushroom cloud rising higher and higher. And
knows not what he does. Deep in the jungle, the blast of the atomic bomb has produced mutants beyond all man's wild imaginations. He has unleashed terror upon his own world.
That's the way they usually open today, and then it shows somebody like Gaunt Rockwell type, with the girl scientist played by Vanessa Redgrave, and they get in this plane, and they're going out on some innocent adventure, you see, in the jungles of Peru, some wild jungles, and their plane crashes. Have you noticed how innocent all those plane crashes are? Yeah, they come down in total mountainous territory. With the 200-foot trees, with the cobras, and the plane is coming in fast, and it crashes. The next scene, you see them all climbing out. They're all totally unhurt, except, you know, their clothes are a little messed up here and there. They never, you know. But that's part of the conventions. And we know that the atom bomb has produced a terrible mutant, which will come out, and he will ravage the countryside for miles around. It's usually a prehistoric monster which has been unloosed, that was, by the way, buried in a mountain many years ago, and now he's leashed or unleashed, or it's a mutant which has produced fantastic growth cells which have caused an innocent alligator to grow to the size of let's say the Empire State Building, and now he's ravening with eyes, red eyes, you see. And in the end, it ends up that after the young scientist and his girlfriend and the young army officer have successfully saved the world, you see another shot of the atom bomb. It goes like this.
When will man learn that the only true force in the world is love, he must learn to live in peace and harmony with his fellow man. Watch the skies. The next time may be too late. Boom. We will return.
The end, Republic Pictures. And everybody gets up and says, oh boy, let's go back to the place and get some more pizzas. And that's the convention. Well, tonight I'm taking time out, a little time out, to pay homage to what could be very well one of the very last of his breed. You want to hear the story of a fantastic true Marlboro man who was just passed? In fact, I received from one of my spies, I received the story about him, and there's a picture of him. I received the story from the Toronto Globe and Mail, May 5th, and I have it here, and it's from Toronto. And it's a story about the passing of a great Marlboro man. It's the only way you can describe him. You notice almost all of our Marlboro types, though, are always shown in the West. You never see a Marlboro man, say, for example, on the decks of a heaving Grand Banks Fisher boat. You see, which is real Marlboro world anyway. I mean. And you never see him. And actually, you know, the curious thing about it is that the world of the West, and I know, you know, something about the West. I spent a week on one of the greatest ranches in Texas. The world of the West is completely automated. I mean, you know, it's a little discouraging to come into a cowboy's living room and discover, you know, that he's got a Western Union ticker tape to keep up with the market. And, he's got a color TV set, you know, which brings him cable TV shows direct from Dallas. And it's not at all the way you think. And our idea of the West, of course, is based on old Gary Cooper movies. We figure somewhere Gary Cooper still stalks little lonesome towns, you see, with his six guns strapped to his side. And yet, the real world, where it's still going on, we hardly ever talk about it. And so, give me a little of that great, fantastic Marlboro music. I now transport you into the land where a man is a man, and women are damn glad of it. This concerned radio station pays homage to what could very well be one of the very last of his breed. Andy Tyson, the man who every year trapped more wolves than anyone else in Ontario, was killed in his pickup truck in a head-on crash on Highway 69, 11 miles south of Sudbury, Ontario, late Sunday night. Andy, 5 feet, 5 inches, blue-eyed, hard-muscled, was on his way from McGregor Bay on Mantuline Island to his home at Killarney on Georgian Bay. En route, he would have passed the Tyson Lake area, named after his grandfather, where, in the past 40 years, he has trapped up to 1,000 timber wolves. Yesterday, forestry officials, fellow trappers, lumberjacks, and bush pilots all over the wilderness mourned his passing. He was one of the greatest bushmen who ever lived. Not only was he a great trapper, but he was one of the greatest of deer hunting guides and fishermen, said veteran bush pilot Jimmy Bell of Austin Airways. For years, Mr. Bell, Rusty Blakey, Harold McCracken, and other Austin pilots flew Andy in and out of the wild Tyson Lake area. Brought in his supplies and ferried out his furs as he spent winter after winter in the trackless wilderness. Besides trapping wolves, he was good for a catch of more than 130 beavers a year. The Tyson Lake area was trapped first by his grandfather, Miles Big Jack Tyson, who lived to 96, and by his father, Little Johnny, before Andy took over. He knew the 150 square mile area like the back of his hand. His success with wolves, he said, was because he understood them. He understood every thought they had. They understood and knew him. Working on this theory, he put in as many as 40 snares in one small area. Then tracks in the snow would tell the story of how, when one wolf was caught, the others would run about wildly, eventually getting caught themselves. Sometimes he'd catch as many as 5 at a time. He said he didn't hate wolves. They were part of nature's scheme of things. Yet he had seen too many deer torn apart and left to die in the snow to feel remorse at killing them. And so each takes his own, he said. I kill wolves, wolves kill deer. And so it goes. His skill in the bush was legendary. Once while hunting with a brother-in-law in November, he killed a deer on a shoal about a quarter of a mile from shore on a district lake. This deer was to be his winter's meat. As they started to butcher the deer, a wind carried the boat off the shoal. It was hopeless to think that someone might come to their aid in the trackless wilderness. He made a pouch out of the deer's stomach, blew it up, and tied it with a thong made from the hide, and using it as a float, tied to his back, he swam ashore in the icy water. He had the utmost respect for the intelligence of wild animals. He boiled his snares and handled them with gloves before putting them out. When wolf trapping, he always rode on the sleigh hauled by his 5-dog team. It's a little hard on the dogs, but you can't walk on snowshoes, even in deep snow, without leaving a scent of man for days, he would say. In giant blizzards or during breakup, when scent was quickly obliterated, it didn't matter. He was a quiet, shy man when in Sudbury or Toronto, where he sometimes visited the Canadian National Sportsman Show. But in his own environment, back in the deep bush, he was the most entertaining of companions. He had never been to school, but he had a never-ending flow of original comment, anecdote, and a perpetual supply of continual wit that flowed out of him. How you like that? Isn't that a fantastic story? You want to hear a little bit more about him? Just a little bit.
His wife, Bernadette, lived with him all winter in their cabin at Tyson Lake, moving into Killarney in the spring. Their first daughter died of polio on a plane, taking her to the hospital for sick children. When they returned to the cabin, he saw that that loneliness was breaking his wife's heart. So he went into Sudbury and put an advertisement in the paper saying they wanted to borrow a child. They brought a four-year-old boy who stayed with them all that winter. And in fact, he was on his way to the camp where this kid was going to camp that he was killed in the automobile accident, a head-on collision in his pickup truck, carrying his equipment back from the great winter in the bush. How about that story? I mean, yeah, there he is, Andy Tyson. What a character. Here's a picture of him standing there. See? And it's just, and the caption is great. It just says, it shows him standing there and he's got his snow clothes on, you know, and he's holding a wolf. And underneath it says, Tyson of Tyson Lake. Man, whoa. Now, there is. You know, speaking of meeting real Marlboro men, I mean, the real thing. I remember one time, I'll tell you a little story of my own, of actually being involved with a Marlboro man. I was in Peru, and you'll find people who really are involved in real things are almost invariably the ones I've run into. In fact, I will say invariably. Maybe because they've seen too many things and because they know how quickly the end can come in the wilderness. They're very, very laconic. And they have an almost casual attitude towards things which would flip the ordinary guy just out of his bird. I mean, it really would. Maybe that's the difference between urban man and, let's say, wilderness man. That urban man feels afraid of his environment constantly. He's always afraid, and he hides. He's continually skulking, and he locks things, and he's, in other words, he is really afraid because in a way he's surrounded by the biggest, most dangerous game of all. Guess what? You know, I saw recently on a list of, a naturalist list of what they called threatened species. You ever seen that list of threatened species like the whooping crane and the crocodile and so on? Well, I wonder when some really hip naturalist is going to put man on that list. Because I think man is a threatened species. I think he really is today. And I'm not talking politically, essentially. Of course, it all boils down to that ultimately because man is a political creature. But I think he's a threatened species. And he's threatened by the very thing that threatens every species, weaknesses in himself. That's what ultimately threatens a species. And so if you take the dinosaurs, the great reptiles, they disappeared from the world, although don't put them down. They spent a long time on this earth, and they were king of the earth for something like 60 million years. So they weren't a flash in the pan. But nevertheless, they died because their inability to adapt to changing conditions. They were conservative. They really were. And they died. They died because when the temperature changed, when the world became more temperate, they went down the drain. And it was sad. And I think that as a threatened species, I'm proposing, Jimmy, here, that you've seen the naturalist list of threatened species, you know, like the whooping crane and so on, that man be placed on that list. That man is also being threatened by his own shortcomings, like all other creatures that are threatened. That his shortcomings are what we call the seven deadly sins. These are shortcomings. Greed. That's right. Greed, lust, hate. These are all what used to be called the seven deadly sins, tongue-in-cheek, and ultimately they were threatening us. Oddly enough, that man is devouring himself with greed. As a matter of fact, I'd say 90% of our pollution comes from just that one source itself, greed. I mean, it sure does. And selfishness, this is one of the seven deadly sins. Ego, these are all part of it. And because of this weakness, which is a fatal one. And it took a long time for it to, you know, get to the point where it was fatal. Like many long lingering malignant diseases, it takes a long time for the coup de grace. That we're now beginning to suspect that we may be undone by the very things, you know, that a lot of people just sort of laughed at. Now, ultimately, when you talk about conservative, liberal, radical, whatever these labels may be, that ultimately they all stem from variations on one thing. And that's the seven things that have always been called man's weaknesses: greed, lust, aggression. These are all things which, we're about the only creature, of course, that's ever been. There's one or two. I take exception. A lot of people say we're the only one, but this is not so. That there are very few creatures that actually will kill out of the love of killing. And that will, and this is what is called hunting. It's also called war in some cases. In addition to that, will kill his own kind in great numbers. It's very rare to find any animal that does this, that will kill his own kind. He may kill other kinds around him, but it's rare. Now, the only time that an animal will kill his own kind is because usually over a basic situation of sex, for example, you will find two animals will fight to the end to determine which one is going to be head of the herd, which ultimately resolves itself into a sexual problem in animals' cases. But men will fight over abstracts. They will fight over will-o'-the-wisps, words like freedom, words like truth and love and beauty and all the... And they do fight over women, too, but that's usually an individual fight. You see, that's man against man. That is not society against society. And so ultimately, we should be placed on the list of threatened creatures. But you know, I think one of the things that comes the difference between the urban man today and the so-called wilderness man is what they're afraid of. The urban man is afraid of his fellow man. He rarely is afraid of nature. So you don't find people hiding in their under the daybed because they're afraid that lightning's going to strike in the New York. You don't find people, hiding behind the garage door because of the Sirocco wind is blowing. No, you'll find guys doing exactly that because the guy next door is out after him. his fellow man, his brother, if I can use that expression. And so when you run into the real Marlboro man, and I'm using that in its generic sense, you'll find that he accepts his fellow man with absolute equanimity, because out on the wilderness, you see, in most cases, in the wilderness, you've got too many things to keep in the air. You're too concerned with the, let's say, the destruction by forces beyond your control to deal with the neighboring guy. You need him. And so the great moment I remember with being with a true Marlboro man, I was with a bush pilot who had flown for 9 years in light planes in the uncharted areas of the wilderness, the true wilderness. And I'm talking not about the North Woods in Canada. I'm talking about the true wilderness of one of the last unexplored areas in the world, in Amazonia, in the Amazon jungles, at the headwaters of the Amazon. Well, now, this is the part of the world where if you go down in an airplane, there is no coming back. And it's a fact. It's not a theory, it's a fact. Primarily because you're 1,000 miles, let's say, by your aircraft. You have flown 1,000 miles away from the nearest habitation, and the jungle below you is infinitely hostile, ranging all the way from thousands of types of uncharted deadly diseases to an incredible variety of voracious animals that are just as delighted to make of you an hors d'oeuvre as look at you. And in addition to that, the fantastic heat of the jungle, and it's almost completely swamp, which makes it impossible for a man to travel more than 100 yards in a day of struggling. So to get back, it's all over. You're not going to do it. And so we were flying over this vast carpet of jungle. And here's this bush pilot who's been flying over this for years. 9 years. A single-engine plane, in case you're curious. In case you're curious even more than that, if you're technical-minded, we were flying in a Helio Courier, which is a special type of STOL aircraft with floats. And we're flying at 8,000 feet, and I'm in the right-hand seat. And we've just taken off from a jungle river, which was a tiny tributary to the final river, which ultimately becomes the Amazon. And we are at a minimum of 800 miles from the nearest base we are flying. And it's a fantastic sight. There's no way to describe it. It really is, it's a sight that is beyond any sight I've ever seen in the world. Stretching from one horizon to the other is what looks like a magnificent woolen carpet, unbroken, rich green, it's all. And occasionally, you see a great vast butte rise out of it, tremendous mountain rise 15,000 feet, just suddenly stick out of this. And we're riding high in the air. And off to our left, was a jungle thunderstorm. It didn't cover, I would say, maybe a half mile at the most at the base. You could see this thunderstorm just standing up like a atomic cloud, a mushroom cloud just laying over a part of the jungle. And we were flying around them. They were growing out of the jungle like flowers. There must have been maybe 10 or 15 of these just extending up. And they would rise up to heights of maybe 20 or 30,000 feet, these great thundering jungle rains. Each one, by the way, deadly. Containing winds, vertical winds, of upwards of 600 to 800 miles an hour that could tear an aircraft into shreds just in an instant. And we're flying high up at 8,000 feet over this fantastic world. And I asked him, I said, what happens if we go down? Said nothing. Said, well, we just don't go down, that's all. I said, what happens if we do? And he said, well, I'll tell you one. He said, you see way over there next to that mountain? And I said, yeah. He says, well, 2 years ago, a friend of mine went down in that area. I said, they ever find him? He said, no. We just know the general area he went down in. He was radioing us to the last when he went in. I said, you mean he's over there now? He says, somewhere, yeah, the plane is in that. He says, because the jungle, the instant the plane goes into the jungle, it's swallowed up. It can't be seen from the surface. Just, it's like some great green sea of quicksand. Just, he's gone. And something happened. The catch on the door, these are the way disasters occur. The catch on the door of the Helio Courier gave way, and bam, the door slammed open. We were moving through the air at about 135 miles an hour, which made a tremendous in-sucking draft. The air sucked into the aircraft, and instantly it disappeared. His clipboard, with all of his charts, his maps, gone. And you could see it spiraling down, 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 8,000 feet into the jungle. And right this minute, there is a clipboard in a trackless jungle in Peru. A clipboard with aerial maps, sectionals of this trackless jungle. Just a few lines and a few radio frequencies and a contour map of that area, that great unexplored area. It's laying there right now, probably next to some tree. He said to me, he says, you hang on to the belt. He says, I'll hook the belt onto your belt and hold on. He says, now hold on to your belt. He says, you try to swing the door closed. So I hung out of the airplane, looking down through the floats, and I was able to get that door back. And he pulled it back, and together, the two of us twisted the thing and tied a leather strap around the door to hold it tight. I said, what about the charts? Now what? So, well, so I know where we are. He sat flown over this maybe 100 times in the last 9 years. And we just kept flying without the slightest hint of a flap. What he was thinking, what he was worrying about, I don't know. But he never showed a sign of it. Yipe. Now, that's a true story. That's a true story. Now, for those of you who don't know what happened there, it wasn't until, you know, a year or so later that I began to realize what we had done, what, you know, what had happened to us there. That he had lost all of his charts. Now, if you know anything about flying, you realize, especially when you're flying by mostly by radio instruments, these charts are practically indispensable. And yet, you didn't see him sweat. You didn't see him get all excited. He just flew the plane. And I suspect that Andy Tyson would have understood him. When the winds come howling out of the north. And so, wherever they are, somewhere in our world, there's one listening now tonight. You know, radio, somewhere up in Greenland. You know, we get a lot of listeners in Greenland. Some guy up in Greenland, or maybe someplace up in Labrador is hearing this, and he's saying to his friend, oh, listen to all this bunk. Listen to all this stuff. Listen to this guy just jabbering out. Oh, say, Luke, when you go out, would you bring my rifle back in? I think I heard a wolf here last night. He's been nosing around out there in the supplies. Listen to all this garbage this guy's talking about. Why, you'd think that some guys were brave or something like that. And so the great nostalgia for the wilderness goes on. The great search for the noble savage. Well, fellow members of a threatened species, it's been a short but happy, merry ride, hasn't it? Who knows how long it'll go on? Hang loose, bumper to bumper, as you struggle your way back from Jones Beach tonight. How did you like the great outdoors?